information crowded into his office. Unhappily, all I can tell you at this time is that it's likely to get still worse before it gets any better. But, the complainer began, waving both hands in the air, I'm sure all of you are well aware of the danger the entire League faces, Tartarian continued, overriding the other man ruthlessly. At this time, all of our available warships are tied down defending major ports. I'm afraid it's simply impossible to free any of them up to protect our shipping. Assuming, even for an instant, that they could somehow fight their way out of harbor against the Carizian Navy, he added to himself. As I've already told you, Earl Anvil Rock has agreed to assign every available man to coast defense. What can be done is being done, and I assure you all that we will continue to search for additional measures we can implement. But, in all honesty, our resources are so heavily committed to resisting the invasion that I very much doubt we'll be able to make much difference against these shipping and coastal raids. I'm sorry, but that's simply the way it is, and I'm not going to sit here and lie to you by making promises I can't keep. The loudmouth, with the waving hands, had opened his mouth again while Tartarian was talking. Now he closed it with a snap, and looked around him at his fellow delegates. Most of them looked as angry and unhappy as he did, but several of them were also shaking their heads at him, and Tartarian felt a trickle of relief. What he just told them obviously wasn't what they wanted to hear, but there was no way any reasonable man could have disputed a single thing he'd said. Fortunately, there were enough reasonable men in the delegation to get them back out of Tartarian's office without his actually having to order the loudmouth taken out and shot. Not, the Earl reflected, standing as his visitors filed back out the door, that it wouldn't have been much more satisfying to just go ahead and have him shot. Surely the prince wouldn't begrudge me one little execution after all of the crap I've diverted from the palace. The thought restored some needed balance to his day, and he snorted in harsh amusement. Maybe he owed that big-mouthed idiot some thanks after all. It wasn't likely that he was going to find anything else to amuse him today. He glanced at the clock ticking away on his wall and grimaced. If he left now, he'd just be in time for this afternoon's meeting of Prince Hector's senior advisers. Which, he thought, is probably going to be even less amusing than this meeting was.
My prince, I don't want to sound like I sympathize overmuch with the pain-in-the-arse bleaters who have been besieging Tarrell's office, but they do have a point. Sir Lindar Raymond said almost apologetically.
Prince Hector gave him a moderately ugly glance, but the treasurer didn't flinch. First, because what he'd said was true, and second, because he knew Hector's ire wasn't actually directed at him.
I'm not saying I plan on shedding any tears over their personal losses, my prince, he said. I'm only trying to point out two things. First, we're suffering not simply property and financial losses, but also the loss of capabilities we may need badly later. And second, the perception that the Carizians can operate with impunity along the coast of the capital duchy itself is beginning to have a serious impact on your subjects' morale. I can see definite signs of that among the members of the Merchant and Manufactory Associations, and I'm sure it's affecting all of our people to at least some extent.
I can't disagree with anything Lindar's just said, my prince, Tartarian said before Hector could speak. The problem is that I don't see anything we can do about it. Caleb's scouts have located every warship we have. He has his damned schooners patrolling off of every port where they found one of my galleons. And every one of those schooners has a squadron or so of Carizian galleons waiting, just out of sight from shore, to be summoned if any of my captains tries to put to sea.
Could we possibly transfer some additional strength from the Dark Hills?
Raymond asked anxiously, looking back and forth between Hector and Earl Anvil Rock.
I don't see how, Anvil Rock began, but Hector cut him off.
No, he said firmly, almost harshly.
Then he shook his head, like a horse irritated by a fly, and smiled a little crookedly at Raymond.
I'm not trying to bite your head off, Lindar. To be honest, I'd like to bite someone's head off, if only to relieve my frustration. But I don't intend to start with the man who manages my finances, and who's only trying to tell me the truth.
Raymond returned his prince's smile and bobbed his head in acknowledgement of the semi-apology, and Hector continued.
At the moment, Corin's position at Talbot Pass is the only thing keeping Caleb's entire army out of Manchir. I rather suspect that what he could do with 40 or 50,000 Marines, especially since all of them seem to have those Shanway damned rifles, would dwarf what we're seeing now. Not to mention costing me the capital, which would also have a somewhat negative effect on morale.
I understand that, my prince, Raymond said. At the same time, though, I'm worried about the possibility Terrell raised at the very beginning. What if Caleb decides to use his transports to swing his entire army around behind Sir Corin without ever attacking his position at Talbor?
He might still do that, Anvil Rock said.
The Earl looked older than he had a month or two before. The shocking totality of his son's defeat at Harrell's Crossing, and the news that Sir Charles Doyle had been seriously wounded and captured by the Carizians, had shaken him badly. As he and Hector had pored over Garvey's reports, they'd realized that what had happened was certainly not his fault, or, for that matter, anyone else's. The fact that he'd gotten even 4,000 of his infantry and virtually all of his cavalry out of the Carizian trap was remarkable under the circumstances, and also explained what had happened to Doyle and virtually all of his artillerists. But what had happened at Harrell's Crossing was a grim warning that any future battle in anything remotely like open terrain would be an expensive proposition. And it hadn't done the confidence and morale of his troops one bit of good either.
He might still do it, Anvil Rock repeated. In fact, I half expect him to. At the moment, according to our own scouts, he's short of the troop lift he'd need to re-embark his entire army. It sounds as if he had too much shipping for Deros and sent the rest of his transports back to Chisholm or Zebediah to ride out the storm season. That's probably what's stopping him for now. He doesn't want to send half of his army out to the end of a limb Corin might manage to saw off behind him. And he's also still very short of cavalry. It doesn't look like he has more than 4,000 or 5,000 horse total, which means that once he gets inland, we have the mobility advantage.
Do you think he'll move to his right, use one of the more northern passes instead? Tartarian asked,
and Anvil Rock shook his head.
I doubt it, for a couple of reasons. First, as I just said, he's very short on cavalry. If he starts pulling troops away from Talbor and sending them north, Corin has Windshare's cavalry scouts hovering off Caleb's flanks, watching for exactly something like that. If he heads inland with an infantry army, Windshare will definitely be able to get a force into position to block any of the other passes before he reaches them. Cavalry alone isn't going to stop Carizian Marines with rifles, of course. But Windshare's troopers will at least slow them down, and Corin's infantry can march just as quickly as Carizians can. Not only that, but there are defensive positions in most of those passes which are almost as good as the ground at Talbor. Not quite, but almost. So he's not going to gain any significant tactical advantage by moving north, and doing that would also take him further away from his own base of operations and from the coast, where he can best utilize his sea power advantage effectively.
Which he isn't going to want to do, Tartarian said, nodding in understanding and agreement.
Exactly. Anvil Rock grimaced. I'm not proposing any sort of boundless optimism here, but I'm beginning to think Caleb may plan on staying put in Derwin until he decides he can risk the weather and bring his transports back to Deros. At that point, of course, I'm afraid he is going to look for ways to break his army loose in Corrin's rear by hitting us here, closer to the capital.
He won't take on Manchir's batteries, Hector said confidently. And by the time he could get here, the earthworks you and your men are throwing up to cover the landward side of the city are going to be almost as tough.
Agreed. Anvil Rock nodded, but his expression remained unhappy. I'm not really concerned about the capital's immediate security, my prince. He can have all of the rifles he wants, but as long as our men keep their heads down behind a good, solid earthwork, he won't be able to get at them without coming into musket range. And as nasty as his field artillery is, it doesn't have the range or the weight to stand up to the heavy guns we're mounting in the fortifications. He'd need siege artillery for that, and we've seen no sign of such heavy guns yet. Of course, he can always land dozens of heavy guns from his fleet, but he's going to want to have a secure anchorage somewhere close to Manchir before he does that. He's certainly not going to want to drag naval guns and carriages any further overland than he absolutely has to. But if he manages to pen up a substantial portion of our troop strength as a garrison here in the capital, that frees his own forces to maneuver against other cities, or inflict damage on our manufactories and farms that would make anything we've seen out of his landing parties so far seem like no more than a minor annoyance. If he puts the capital under siege, our situation is going to be about as grim as it gets.
If he manages that, then I may have to go ahead and sue for terms.
Hector looked like a man sucking on sour persimmon figs.
My prince, Earl Corus began, his own expression concerned, but Hector shook his head. Don't say it, Philip. And don't think you're worrying about anything I haven't worried about. Still, that fat little bugger Narman seems to have made out remarkably well, doesn't he?
Hector's expression turned more sour than ever.
Anything less like a cat lizard than the rotund Prince of Emerald would be difficult to imagine, but the little bastard had most definitely landed on his feet. Hector didn't know which irritated him more. The fact that Narman had so promptly and effortlessly deserted to the other side and done so damnably well out of it, or the fact that he himself had obviously been underestimating the Emeraldian for years.
With all due respect, my prince, Corus said.
Oh, I know how much Caleb hates me. To be honest, I can't say I blame him. In his shoes, I'd probably feel the same. Now, let's be fair. If I were in his shoes, I would hate my guts. After all, I've been trying to break Karis for years now, and it was my navy which managed to kill his father at Darko Sound. On the other hand, Harald died in open battle, and I'm not the one who tried to have Caleb himself assassinated and conspired with his cousin to usurp his father's throne. Oh, and let's not forget that a successful usurpation would have required his father's murder as well. And probably his younger brother's, too.
No, Corus acknowledged, in the voice of a man edging delicately into dangerous waters. Still, my prince, don't forget that Caleb is a married man now. And however he might feel about you, I don't believe there's much question about how Charlian feels.
Believe me, that's not a point I'm likely to forget.
Hector showed his teeth in what definitely was not a smile.
If it weren't for that unfortunate little fact, I might already have tried opening negotiations with him. Still, if he has the choice between making at least minimal concessions to me or seeing several thousand more people killed, and this time quite a few of them would be his men, not just ours, he may decide to turn reasonable. Whatever else he may be, and leaving aside our own propaganda on that point, he's not really a bloodthirsty monster, you know. An extraordinarily dangerous and pissed-off young man, I'll grant you, but not a monster. Corus looked dubious, but he allowed the point to drop, and Hector turned his attention back to Anvil Rock and Tartarian. I don't know if I'm completely convinced by your logic, Rysel. It sounds reasonable, mind you, and I don't have any better analysis to offer. I just don't want us to get too wedded to the belief that he's going to simply sit there until he's recalled more of his transports. For now, though, I see no option but to continue as we are while pressing the fortification of the capital as hard as we can. In the meantime, though, there is one precaution I want to take. He paused, and his advisers looked at one another as the silence stretched out. Finally, Corus cleared his throat.
Yes, my prince?
I want Iris and Divan safely out of Coruscant. Hector said the words as if they cost him physical pain, and Corus's eyebrows rose in astonishment. I know Iris will fight me on this one, Hector continued. And I know there are risks involved, and not just the usual ones of a normal voyage long enough to get them somewhere more or less safe. Outside my protection, the two of them become potential hostages. But if they're outside Caleb's reach as well, they also represent a potential trump card tucked away in my tunic pocket. He can't simply arbitrarily reject an invitation to negotiate in favor of taking my head when he knows that Divan will still be alive to be used against him, even if both Iris and I are killed. And, to be honest, I'm not quite as confident as I'd like to be that he won't decide it's time to be rid of the House of Dakin once and for all. Or of its male members, at any rate, he added just a bit more harshly, and his face turned briefly, hard as marble.
But where would you send them, my prince? And how would you get them past Caleb's navy?
I'll get them past Caleb by selling half my soul and my left testicle to the Sidarmachian ambassador, Hector said dryly. He's almost Carizian in his taste for nice tall stacks of marks. I think he'll agree to grant them sanctuary if I come up with the right inducement, and any ship flying his personal standard is the same as his own embassy. Sidarmach is too important to Karras for Caleb to violate its flag, I think, even if he knows Iris and Divan are aboard.
My prince, Tartarian said very seriously, I advise against relying on that.
Hector raised an eyebrow, and Tartarian shrugged.
First, Sidarmach is friendly enough with Caleb that I'm not completely convinced we can trust Stonar's ambassador in something this important. Secondly, I wouldn't be a bit surprised, given that friendship, if Caleb isn't already receiving regular spy reports from someone on his staff. And if Caleb does learn Iris and Divan are on board that ship, he certainly will intercept it. No doubt he'll be properly horrified by the way one of his captains has exceeded his orders and violated Sidarmachian neutrality. I'm sure he'll promptly release the vessel and probably apologize profusely and pay a handsome indemnity to boot. But if he does, I can assure you that your son and daughter will not be aboard that ship when she docks in Sidarmach.
You may be right, Hector said after a long, silent pause. But I still want them in safety, and not just for political reasons, Taral.
My prince, all of us know that, Tartarian said gently. But if that's what you desire, Please, let us try to find a way which is less likely to deliver them directly into your enemy's hands.
Such as?
Not even Caleb's navy can be everywhere at every moment, my prince. I doubt very much that I could possibly get any of our war galleons to sea without having them intercepted. I think it would be possible to get a single, small, fast vessel out of one of the secondary ports which isn't as heavily picketed, however. Especially if we pick our time and weather carefully. And once a small, unimportant-looking vessel flying, say, Sidarmarkian or Harchongese colors is well away, it's unlikely any Carizian cruiser or privateer is going to bother her, even if they manage to sight her in the first place.
Hector looked suddenly more thoughtful.
You really think that's possible?
He looked at Tartarian with the eyes of an anxious father, as well as a prince, and his naval commander nodded.
My prince, I know how much you love all your children, he said,
very carefully not saying the word daughter, then raised one hand, palm uppermost.
I can't say there's no risk involved in my suggestion. I won't say that. But I will tell you, as one father speaking to another, that if they were my own children, this is still what I would recommend. Of course there's risk involved. I simply believe it's the lowest risk available to us.
Let me think about it, Hector said. You've raised some very telling points, and I'll be honest. The thought of exposing them to this sort of risk, even aboard one of our own ships, frightens me.
If you do send them out of the princedom, my prince, where would you send them to? Corus asked.
I don't have a very long list to choose from, Hector said dryly. For what it's worth, I think they'll probably be safest with James of Delphirac at the moment.
The others frowned, clearly considering what he'd just said. Delphirac was scarcely the most powerful of the mainland realms, but Queen Consort Hylan was Hector's fourth cousin. That would give Iris and Divan at least some blood claim upon King James' protection. And the fact that Delphirac wasn't a player in the traditional power struggles of the mainland's larger kingdoms should minimize the temptation to use Hector's children as pawns. In addition, reports of what had happened to Farad had reached Manchir. It seemed unlikely James was going to feel like doing any favors for Caleb anytime soon, so he was most unlikely to simply turn Iris and Divan over to Karis. Which left...
My prince, Corus said quietly, do you think the temple will allow them to remain in Delphirac?
I don't know, Hector confessed, his face tightening. If Clinton decides any surrender I arrange shows I'm disloyal to the temple, or at least to his precious group of four, there's no telling how he'll react. And if we're wrong, if Caleb does decide he needs my head, and if anything happens to Hector, Iris and Divan will suddenly become even more valuable than they are now. It's not a good solution, it's only the best one I can come up with.
Corus nodded, but his expression was still troubled, and Hector smiled faintly.
I have come up with one way to give them at least a little additional protection, Philip.
You have, my prince?
Corus's tone was suddenly the slightest bit wary, and Hector's smile grew broader.
Indeed I have. In addition to getting Iris and Divan out, Taral is going to get you out. I'll provide you with a writ of authority as Iris's guardian until she comes of age, and of regency in Divan's name, in case... Well...
He shrugged, and Corus frowned.
My prince, I'm honored by your trust, but...
Don't say it. I know a lot of people are going to assume the worst about how you came by those writs. After all, you are my spymaster, aren't you? However, it will be witnessed by the entire council, and I think you'll be able to make its legitimacy stand up. More to the point, I'm going to need someone like you looking out for them. Someone who's accustomed to outthinking other players. I know you don't want to go, and I fully realize that if Caleb is feeling vengeful here in Coruscant, your chances of retaining your earldom won't be very good. But of everyone I can think of here in Manchir, you're the one best suited to advise Iris and keep her out of the church's clutches for as long as you can. Corus looked as if he was tempted to argue, but then, instead, he closed his mouth and nodded.
"Of course I will, my prince," he said quietly.
Hector met his eyes for a moment, then nodded briskly. "Very well," he said crisply. "In that case, I think we're done here for the day."
3. Helen Island, Kingdom of Karis. Empress Charlian angled her parasol carefully as she crossed the mountain valley's grassy field at Earl Grey Harbor's side. The First Counselor had wanted to provide her with a carriage, but after one look at the narrow, twisting track, calling it a road would have constituted physical assault on a perfectly respectable noun. Captain Garrott and Sergeant Seahamper had flatly rejected that possibility. Fortunately, Charlian had always been an excellent horsewoman, although she suspected her style of horsemanship had come as something of a shock to her new Carisian subjects. Well, that was too bad, and she hoped their sensibilities hadn't been bruised, but she wasn't about to begin learning to ride side saddle at this late date. At least she'd had time to have the palace seamstresses run up a new riding habit for her, with the divided skirt made of cotton silk rather than the heavier and sweatier fabric she would have been wearing in Chisholm at this time of year. She found that her northern complexion was profoundly grateful for the Carisian innovation of the parasol, but she'd also decided which 5 months of the year she wanted to spend in Karis and which in Chisholm. Snow was all very well in its place, and no doubt she would eventually miss February in Chiraeth, probably by the time she was, 60 or so, at the very latest. She smiled slightly at the thought, but the smile faded as she considered the loose ring of bodyguards surrounding her alertly, even here. Garrott and Seahamper kept an eagle eye on everything around her. She considered suggesting that they might relax just a little bit, but she knew better. She'd had far too many years to grow accustomed to that sort of omnipresent protectiveness. Besides, it would have hurt their feelings, and at least they'd managed to get over a dozen of Caleb's Carisian guardsmen integrated into their own detail, and still more would be joining it over the next few months. She suspected Garrott had been tempted to protest, at least initially, but if he had, he'd been far too smart to succumb to the temptation. Charlian wasn't about to surround herself with a bunch of foreigners, as if she didn't trust the Carisians to protect her. And she was rather amused by her Carisians' reaction to their new assignment. If anything, they were even more fanatical about protecting their new empress than her original Chisholmians were about protecting their old queen. And the fact that the church has finally gotten around to placing the entire kingdom under the interdict. And I'm sure they'll extend it to the rest of the empire and me as soon as they find out the empire exists only makes things worse. She managed not to grimace as she realized that she'd probably already been excommunicated. Surely the temple had learned about her marriage by now, in which case the group of four's response ought to be arriving fairly shortly. The more fanatical temple loyalists probably wouldn't have worried about it either way, but now even the more hesitant among them can console themselves with the knowledge that the church has formally absolved them of any lingering loyalty to Caleb and the Archbishop. God only knows where that's likely to lead. No wonder Willis and Edward and all the rest of them are so nervous.
And I don't like to think about the way Chisholm is likely to react when word reaches Tirith. Uncle Bertram may be more alarmist than he has to be, but that doesn't mean he's completely wrong either.
She did grimace, mentally at least, at that thought, but then she made herself put it aside. There wasn't anything she could do about it anyway, except to trust her bodyguards here in Karras and Merak Sandirs and her mother in Chisholm. And so she deliberately reached for the distraction of what had brought them here.
"I'm really looking forward to this, my lord," she told Grey Harbor quietly as one of Seamount's aides tapped him on the shoulder and he turned to see her approaching. They were still a good 200 yards away, though, and Grey Harbor looked at her as they continued to stroll towards the naval officer and his assistants.
"To be honest, Your Majesty, I'm not at all sure that I am," the Earl admitted.
She arched a surprised eyebrow, and he grimaced.
"I was a sea officer for too many years, Your Majesty, and Caleb Seamount and Houseman have already managed quite enough innovations to give an old sea-dog like me nightmares. Solid shot is hard enough on a wooden hull without adding this to it, and if Seamount and Houseman can figure out how to make this work, then so can someone else. So eventually we're going to find other people's navies firing the same sort of thing at us, and I don't expect we'll enjoy that very much. For example, I don't like to think what could have happened to the Ferrade attack if their batteries had been equipped with some of these shell-firing guns Seamount is talking about."
"I see a point," she said thoughtfully, although the mention of Ferrade reminded her of other worries. No one in Karras knew, yet, how the group of four was going to respond to the Inquisitor's executions. Not that anyone had any intention of sitting around, paralyzed by indecision, while they waited to find out. Copies of the documents Admiral Rockpoint had captured had been handed to the printers, and the presses had turned out thousands of additional copies for distribution throughout the Empire, and every mainland seaport. She had no intention of rethinking that decision, yet she had to admit that she felt more than a little wary whenever she contemplated the group of four's possible responses. She'd written her husband a long letter, which had been mostly about political matters and decisions, and enclosed a copy of Rockpoint's official report, as well as printed copies of the captured documents along with it. She knew he was going to be as grimly satisfied with the outcome as she'd been, and she'd already suggested that perhaps some additional knighthoods might be in order. But as she reviewed that same report mentally once more, she realized that Grey Harbor had every right to be concerned about what explosive shells might have done to the Admiral's galleons.
Or might do to some other Admiral's ships in the future, she thought rather more grimly.
"I see your point," she repeated out loud. "On the other hand, Caleb said something to me on the same head." It was Grey Harbor's turn to raise an eyebrow, and she shrugged. "He said that once the Slash Lizard is out of its egg, your only option is to ride it or get eaten. So, in this case, our only real choices are whether we'll introduce the changes or find out the hard way that someone else has already done it."
"He said much the same thing to me, and so has Seamount."
For just a moment, Charlian had the oddest sensation that he'd been about to mention another name and changed it to the Commodore's at the last moment.
"And I suppose they're both right about that," he continued before she could pursue that thought. "Even if they aren't, we can't afford to overlook any advantages when the odds against us are so long. So I tell my bad dreams to leave me alone and try to concentrate on what a nasty surprise it's going to be for someone else, at least the first time we use it."
"I hope some of the Baron's other surprises are serving Caleb as well in Coruscant."
Charlian's voice was suddenly lower, darker, and Grey Harbor glanced across at her.
"I know I probably shouldn't,
But I worry about him, she admitted softly. Good, he said equally softly, and smiled at her expression. Your Majesty, I think the way you and Caleb obviously feel about one another may be one of the best things that's ever happened to Karis. You go right on worrying about him. Don't take counsel of your fears and let them rule you, but don't pretend, especially to yourself, that you aren't worried.
I'll try to bear that in mind, my lord. She reached out and gave his arm an affectionate squeeze. I just wish it didn't take so long for letters to travel between here and Coruscant.
So do I, but so far, if you'll pardon my saying so, you've done an excellent job ruling in Caleb's absence.
How far wrong can I go with your advice and Archbishop Michael's to keep me straight? She replied with a smile.
Your Majesty...
Grey Harbor's answering smile actually looked rather more like a grin.
Forgive me, but you are a remarkably stubborn young woman. That's a good thing in a ruler, in many ways, you understand, so don't think I'm complaining. But I strongly suspect that if Michael and I both advised against a course of action you thought was the proper one, you'd listen very carefully and courteously, and then be exquisitely polite when you informed us that we were all going to do it your way.
She started to shake her head, then paused. After a moment, she gave a gurgle of laughter instead.
I'm glad you had an opportunity to get to know Marak Sandirs before you had to leave for home with me. I have the oddest feeling, though, that the better you get to know me, the more you're going to sympathize with Marak. And vice versa, I'm quite sure. He's told me more than once that I could outstubborn a slash lizard with a toothache.
Grey Harbor chuckled.
Why do I suspect that when you were younger, Your Majesty, you knew how to pitch a truly royal temper tantrum?
What do you mean, when I was younger, my lord? She murmured provocatively, and his chuckle turned into a laugh.
I await the moment with trembling and dread, he assured her.
She started to say something else, then stopped as they reached Seamount. She gave Grey Harbor one more smile, then turned to greet the Commodore.
Your Majesty, Seamount said, bowing deeply.
Baron, she replied, and he straightened once more.
I've quite been looking forward to your demonstration ever since I received your last report, she continued.
Well, Your Majesty, I only hope it performs as promised. It has so far, but I've discovered that the first law of demonstrations for royalty is the same one Earl Grey Harbor is fond of quoting about battles.
Indeed, Charlian glanced at the First Counselor, and Grey Harbor shrugged.
What can go wrong will go wrong, Your Majesty, he told her. Although Alfred is probably doing himself an injustice, most of his demonstrations perform as promised. On the other hand, I must confess, when one of his little displays does go awry, it tends to do so rather spectacularly. You may have noticed, for example, that he has you at least 100 yards away from his new infernal device. I'm sure it will prove an unnecessary precaution, of course.
Oh, of course, my lord, Charlian chuckled, and returned her attention to Seamount.
Well, now that you've both conspired to lower my expectations, I trust you're prepared to dazzle me with your success instead.
I certainly hope so, Your Majesty, Seamount said more seriously. And while Earl Grey Harbor is correct when he suggests that I would really prefer not having you physically closer to the weapon than you have to be during the test firings, I would be honored to allow you to examine it before the test.
Test, my lord, Charlian repeated. I thought you'd just referred to it as a demonstration.
Up until the moment we actually deploy a weapon, Your Majesty, all demonstrations are also tests, Seamount replied promptly, and she snorted.
A splendid recovery, my lord, she congratulated him. And now I truly would like to see this new wonder of yours.
Of course, Your Majesty, if you would accompany me, please.
Seamount led the way across to the weapon in question, and Charlian's eyes narrowed as she inspected it. It looked rather like a cross between a standard field gun and a carronade, she thought. The barrel was shorter and stubbier than one of the 12-pounders she'd seen demonstrated, but it was longer in proportion to its diameter than a carronade. There was also something a bit peculiar about the way it was mounted on its carriage. It took her a moment to figure out what it was, but then she had it. This weapon had been designed to be elevated to at least twice the elevation of a normal field gun. Not only that, but instead of the wooden wedge all of the other Carizian cannons she'd seen used as a spacer under the breech to hold the gun at its desired elevation, this weapon's cascabel was pierced by a wrist-thick screw with a crank handle on its upper end. Obviously, the gun's elevation was supposed to be adjusted by running the screw up and down, and there was a metal pointer and a scale, graduated in degrees, to measure precisely what that elevation was. "This is an ingenious idea," she commented to Seamount, tapping the crank handle. "Do you intend to go back and apply it to our naval cannon as well, my lord?" "Probably not, Your Majesty." Seamount seemed pleased by the fact that she'd obviously grasped how the new arrangement worked. "First, it adds to the expense and the foundry time required to produce each weapon. More to the point, perhaps, shipboard guns don't require the same fine degree of control. Or perhaps what I should say is that the practical limitations of shipboard gunnery mean this degree of control wouldn't be extraordinarily useful. Ranges are short, both the firing ship and its target are usually moving in more than one direction at the same time, given the normal action of wind and wave, and ruggedness of design and the ability to make quick, rough adjustments in elevation are much more important features than being able to know the exact elevation of the weapon."
"Is the exact elevation truly that critical, my lord?"
"It will be, Your Majesty," he said very seriously. "Dr. Marklin is working on the mathematics for me now, but eventually, using this basic design concept, I imagine it will require a great deal of refinement first, you understand. We should actually be able to fire accurately on targets we can't even see from the gun pit."
"Indeed," Charlian's eyebrows rose. "Your report didn't mention that possibility, my lord."
"Mostly because it's still theoretical, Your Majesty. However, as I'm certain you've observed, this gun can be elevated to a much higher angle than our standard field guns. In fact, to distinguish it from our normal field guns, I've dubbed this a high-angle cannon. I imagine, sailors being sailors and marines being marines, that will undoubtedly be shortened to angle cannon or even just angle." He sighed. "They do have a way of rather brutally simplifying precise terminology."
"I see."
Charlian's lips twitched, but her voice was commendably steady as she continued.
"I assume, however, that there's a specific reason for this high-angle cannon's greater elevation?"
"Indeed, Your Majesty. What I've done is to attempt to recapture some of the catapult's ability to fire on an arced trajectory so as to drop the fired round onto its target at a relatively high angle. That should both increase range for a given projectile velocity and allow us to use indirect fire to engage targets on the other side of walls or hills, the way a skilled catapult crew could." Charlian's eyes widened as the implications of Seamount's explanation sank home.
"That, my lord," she said after a moment, "would be an enormous advantage."
"At least until our enemies figure out how to duplicate it, Your Majesty,"
Grey Harbor pointed out, and she flashed him a smile at the reminder of their earlier conversation.
"That, unfortunately, is unavoidable, Your Majesty," Seamount said rather more heavily. "There's no way we could—"
"Baron Seamount," Charlian interrupted. "There's no need for you to apologize for or explain the inevitability of Earl Greyharbor's observation. I assure you, the Emperor and I are both perfectly aware of that. And, as he pointed out to me, if our enemies adopt our innovations, then ultimately they'll be forced to become increasingly like us, which means the Group of Four's grip on things will start fraying rather badly. And if they don't adopt our innovations, then they systematically undercut their own chances of ever actually defeating us militarily." Seamount nodded respectfully, and Charlian turned her attention to the ammunition cart parked beside his high-angle cannon. The bagged charges of gunpowder were familiar enough, but the gun's projectiles were unlike anything she'd ever seen before. One of them had been laid out for her examination, and she studied it thoughtfully. Instead of a spherical round shot, it was an elongated cylinder with rounded ends, as if someone had stretched a standard round shot to perhaps 5 or 6 times its normal length without increasing its diameter. And its smooth skin was interrupted by a series of studs arranged in 3 rows, which projected outward from it and encircled the projectile in an angled spiral pattern. "These, I take it," she said, touching one of the studs gingerly with a fingertip, "are what engage in the rifling grooves your report described?"
"Precisely, Your Majesty."
Seamount looked even more pleased than before at the evidence Charlian had studied his report with the attention it deserved, and she smiled at him.
"And this," he continued, picking up a wooden plug, "is our fuse. At the moment, at any rate. There are some problems I'm still working on."
Charlian nodded. Seamount, she thought, would always be working on some problem. He was the sort of man who was constitutionally incapable of accepting that anything had attained perfection. "You mentioned that there was a problem with the shell's impact," she said.
"Exactly. This," he waved the wooden plug in his hand, "works adequately for timed detonation. We're still working on refining the composition of the powder we use to improve the consistency with which it burns, but the basic principles are relatively simple. The plug is drilled out and filled with a powder train. The walls of the central cavity are thin enough that they can be easily pierced with an awl. By piercing it at the proper point along the fuse's length before inserting it into the shell, the flash from the powder charge when the shell is fired is admitted to the powder filling, which then burns down to the powder filling of the shell, causing it to detonate. The problem is that this type of fuse is actually going to work better on a spherical shell, such as might be fired from a smoothbore gun, like our current 12-pounders. In fact, Master Hausman is already beginning to produce shells for our field artillery, as well as larger ones for the Navy's 30-pounders, in case they're needed for siege work. We ought to be ready to ship the first of them to Coruscant within another month at the outside."
"And why is—" "Oh, I see. These," Charlian tapped the elongated shell again, "are always going to land point first, aren't they?"
"Yes, they are," Seamount agreed, nodding vigorously. "We've already discovered that putting the fuse on the side of the shell towards the propellant charge doesn't work very well. That means we have to put it on the front, or on one of these on the nose, and fired out of a rifled gun, the shell will always land nose first, which will quite often tend to destroy or crush the fuse before it can explode. With a spherical shell, on the other hand, there's no way to tell which part of the shell will land first. That means the chances are actually quite good that it won't land fuse first, in which case a fuse which hasn't burned all the way down yet would still have an excellent chance of detonating the shell after all.
I see. Charlian frowned. Surely there has to be a solution for the problem, though, my lord. It seems to me that what we really need is a fuse which will detonate the shell only after it strikes its target. It would obviously simplify things enormously if it didn't matter whether or not the powder burned completely consistently in the fuse, or whether the range had been estimated absolutely correctly. For that matter, there must be any number of instances in which it would be much more desirable for the shell to penetrate its target before it exploded.
The Empress, Grey Harbor realized, had just turned Seamount into her adoring slave. Her nimble mind's quick grasp obviously delighted the pudgy artillerist, and he beamed at her as if they were co-conspirators.
"That's exactly right, Your Majesty," he agreed, nodding vigorously. "In fact, that's the very thing I'm working on now."
"And how are you approaching the problem?"
Charlian's expression was intent, and Grey Harbor realized something else. If she'd just captivated Seamount, it was because she was genuinely fascinated by what the Baron had accomplished. She was Seamount's co-conspirator, and the First Counselor had a sudden picture of her in the Commodore's workshop, sleeves rolled up, hands grimy, dirt smudged across her nose, and as happy as a little girl in a candy shop.
"Actually, I'm thinking that what we need is some sort of incendiary composition," Seamount told her. "Something that doesn't need a spark for ignition. Something that ignites from friction, for example. Gunpowder can do that. It's one of the dangers we look for in magazines where it's stored. But gunpowder won't work for this. We need something else. I'm trying several different compositions at the moment, and Dr. Machlin and the Royal College are also working on the problem. In the end, I think, the solution is going to be to make a fuse which is a closed vessel, with its walls coated in the composition we've managed to devise, and something like a heavy ball coated in more of the composition that flies forward when the shell lands and strikes the walls of the vessel, setting off whatever compound you finally come up with, and detonates the shell on impact." Charlian finished for him with a huge smile. "Yes," Seamount beamed back at her. For several seconds, they simply stood there, grinning at each other. Then the Baron gave himself a shake. "Your Majesty, I trust you'll forgive me for saying that you're even quicker at grasping possibilities than the Emperor. And that's saying a great deal indeed."
"Thank you, my lord. That's a compliment I'll treasure," Charlian told him.
Then she inhaled deeply.
"And now, Baron Seamount, I believe you were about to demonstrate to me how to fire an explosive shell to the other side of a wall."
4. The Laughing Bride, City of Telesburg, Kingdom of Karras.
"Excuse me, my lord, but this just arrived."
"Alvin, Alvin!"
The man seated at the table looked up, waved an admonishing finger at the younger man standing in the doorway, and shook his head.
"How many times must I remind you that I'm a simple merchant?"
Archbishop Miles Halcombe asked chidingly.
"Excuse me, my lord, sir."
The younger man colored slightly at the familiar reprimand.
"I'm afraid I'm more of a creature of habit than I'd thought I was."
"We all are, and in some ways that's a good thing. But it's also something that anyone, even a priest, needs to be aware of and guard against, especially now."
"Of course, sir."
The younger man bent his head in a brief bow of acknowledgement, then held out a sealed envelope.
"As I was saying, this just arrived."
"I see."
The man seated at the table took the envelope and turned it slowly in his hands. It was addressed to Edvard Darius at the Laughing Bride,
and he rather thought he recognized the handwriting.
"Thank you, Alvin," he said.
The younger man gave him another brief bow and withdrew from the room. Darius watched him go, then reached to the narrow bookshelf beside his work table and withdrew a copy of The Life of Saint Everard, which had been printed right here in Telesburg. He laid the book on the table, unsealed the envelope, and extracted the several thin sheets of fine, expensive, gilt-edged paper it contained. They were covered in columns of numbers, the new numbers which had originated here in Caris, and he smiled thinly. The cipher in which the letter had been written was based on a technique the church had worked out centuries before, but it amused him in a grim sort of way that the Carisians' own new numbers had made it so much simpler and more effective now that he found himself forced to employ it against them. He laid out another pad of paper, inked his pen, and opened the book. The numbers were arranged in groups of four, and he started turning pages. The cipher was both simple and impossible to break without the key, albeit at the price of a certain cumbersomeness. The first number in each group referred to a specific page in St. Everard's biography. The second number referred to a paragraph on that page, the third referred to a sentence in that paragraph, and the fourth referred to a specific word in that sentence. Without knowing which book the cipher was based upon, no one could possibly break the code. "Which is undoubtedly a good thing at the moment," he reflected, as he began laboriously counting. "I think, though, that it might not be a bad idea to suggest that our friend use less expensive paper in the future. Wave Thunder might not be able to break the cipher, but I'll bet his agents could probably locate everyone who sells this particular paper, and find out who they sold it to." He worked his way slowly but steadily through the entire letter, transcribing the indicated words without really trying to read them. He knew his own impatience, and he was well aware of his ability to allow himself to succumb to distraction when faced with tasks like this one. As a young monk, he'd always found the traditional discipline of the scriptorium boring beyond words, not to mention pointless, given the existence of printing presses and movable type. In fact, he'd been disciplined more than once for finding ways to amuse himself when he ought to have been attending to his copyist's duties. But although his present task's demand for exact accuracy and laborious precision was just as great, its purpose was deadly important, and so he forced himself to complete the entire task before he turned back to the very beginning and began methodically reading. It took him several minutes to complete the transcribed text, and his eyes narrowed as he worked his way through it. Then he sat back, gazing up at the ceiling while he contemplated what he'd read. He stayed that way for the better part of half an hour, then straightened abruptly.
"Alvin!"
"Yes, sir?"
Alvin Shumay reappeared in the doorway as if by magic, and despite the tension the letter from the palace had generated, Halcombe smiled slightly. The youthful priest would never admit it, of course, but Halcombe knew he'd been hovering outside the door, consumed by curiosity. Then the bishop thought about what that letter had actually said, and the temptation to smile disappeared.
"We need a letter. Two letters, actually. One to our friend in the palace, and one for our friend in the mountains."
"Yes, sir." Shumay sat down on the opposite side of the table, took the pen Halcombe had laid aside, and prepared to take notes.
"Whenever you're ready, sir."
"According to our friend here in Telesburg," Halcombe began, tapping the letter he'd decoded, "the Duke has mentioned St. Agatha's to the Empress, and, as expected, she's expressed an interest in visiting the convent."
Unfortunately, the Royal Guard... Excuse me. He smiled thinly. I mean the Imperial Guard, of course, is being rather more solicitous of her security than we'd hoped. Our friend doesn't yet know just how strongly they intend to reinforce her normal